Up in the morning at the crack of dawn, down to the kitchen with my long johns on. Get out the skillet, put the flapjacks on, I'm a-going fishing. Take a deep breath of the morning air, it'll chase your worries and lose your cares. Grab your rod and I'll meet you there, I'm a-going fishing.
Jeff Perrin has owned the Fly Fisher's Place in Sisters, Oregon since 1991. He has fished the rivers and lakes of Central Oregon for much longer than that, and he knows a thing or two about fly fishing. His weekly fishing reports at flyfishersplace.com are the best in Central Oregon. In this episode, we'll continue a short series focused on the hatches and lives of the bugs that trout like to eat. Last time we talked about the stonefly, this time the mayfly. Jeff Perrin, welcome back to the Radical Songbook Podcast.
Great to be here again, and really, really fun to be talking about mayflies.
All right.
So, you know, mayflies have always been my favorite of the trout stream insects. Ever since I, you know, started really focusing my life on in and around fly fishing, mayfly hatches have been my favorite because mayfly hatches are identifiable for most people. You know, you can look at a tiny olive mayfly and know that that's a blue-wing olive. You can look at a big green mayfly with three tails and know that that's a green drake, and a yellow mayfly with three tails is a pale morning dun. So, you know, they have key identifying factors, body parts usually, or sizes, that make it easy for, you know, just the common, you know, person that's out there fishing, they can look at them and really identify them themselves. Where our next talk is going to be about caddisflies, and caddis are quite a bit harder to identify on our own. Mayflies are also very elegant to see. Their way that their body structure and their elongated, you know, tails and really pretty upright wings. They're just an elegant little creature. So I love to look at them. And then on top of that, they have a fascinating life cycle, which I'm really going to dive into today during our talk. I don't know whether you know this, but fossil archives show that mayflies were here when dinosaurs were here. So they've been around for a long, long time. And obviously, you know, over those millions of years, there's been a lot of evolution, you know, within the mayfly groups, and the mayflies that we're seeing on the Metolius today are, you know, most likely not the same mayflies that were here when you know, the Brontosaurus was moving through the trees here. So there are 10 important mayflies to our region, and two of these species occur on the lakes, and the other 8 occur on the rivers, really throughout the West. The mayflies that are west of the Mississippi are, in most cases, or almost all cases, different genuses than the mayflies found out east. I'll talk about an exception later on. Mayflies that we see here in Central Oregon that are really common are blue-wing olives, March browns, pale morning duns, pale evening duns, Epeorus and Synigmula, green drakes, which are a really great hatch on the Metolius right now, mahogany duns, and then on the lakes we get two species of mayflies that are particularly important on our Central Oregon lakes, Calabatus by far being the most important species, and then a little tiny mayfly that hatches at Crane Prairie and Hosmer and some of the other lakes called a Cenus. All of those become trout food at some point. Mayflies have an incomplete metamorphosis, meaning they don't have to pupate before they transition from the larva, which are called nymphs, to the adult. In this case, we're going to say adult with an asterisk. And why do we say adult with an asterisk? Well, remember that I said that mayflies have a fascinating life cycle, and here's one example. So during the emergence of the nymph, the nymph transitions to a stage in the life cycle us anglers called duns, but those are actually called sub-imagos by entomologists. So that's the entomology term, sub-imago. Most anglers call them duns, and they got that name back in, you know, probably the 1800s, when fly fishing was first starting to get popular around England, because the color of many mayfly wings is that kind of grayish color. And in the horse world, that color is called dun, D-U-N. So that's how they got that name. So for instance, a pale morning dun or a March brown dun or a blue wing olive dun have kind of grayish colored wings. And those subimagos are the first stage of the adult stage of the insects. And arguably, this is the most fun time to fish to hatch, because an hour before the first winged mayflies start popping on the surface of the river or the lake, the nymphs are swimming and drifting, and they eventually ascend to the surface and into our world above the water. So during this time, we anglers would be inclined to fish the nymphs early on, like, you know, an hour or two before the hatch, we'd be fishing little nymphs to imitate what's coming up. And then we'd fish one of the many flies designed to imitate the in-between stage called an emerger, which is very important. And as the timing of the hatch moves forward, we'd also find ourselves tying on the duns to our micro-thin leaders. That's, you know, as you know, you and I are both longtime anglers. It's not easy to always fool a trout, right?
It's hard to see my fly sometimes, too.
Well, exactly. Yeah, and some of these flies are pretty small, so they become harder and harder to see. And some of them sit really close into the film of the surface of the water, and that adds to the frustration of being able to see them. So it takes practice to do this well. So to add to all that madness, and it is certainly a madness in this addicting game of cat and mouse, is that some of the emergers become so crippled during the transition period between nymph and the dun that they're unable to fly away, and the trout will, what we call in the angling world, key into that stage, which simply means that they favor eating the cripples and nothing else. So you have to have flies in your box that would match that stage as well. It gets crazy, really. You know, it's maddening, but it's really fun to be able to put it all together and have success. But, you know, there's more to it after that. So the subimago transitions to what's called an imago after the mayfly flies away from the water. They go into the nearby vegetation or the trees to make a final molt to the spinner stage. At this stage, they're able to mate, and males and females both have clear wings, longer tails, and many also change body color, though not all species do. A lot of the females become rust-colored at the mating and egg-laying stage, hence the popularity of the fly, the rusty spinner. Okay, so that's a really interesting thing that happens, and in some cases you can actually see it occurring. I mentioned that little mayfly called the Cenus that hatches on the lakes. If you're at Hosmer Lake here in the next few weeks and throughout most of the summer at dusk, especially on a warm, calm evening, you'll see the Cenus mayflies hatch out. The nymphs will swim from the bottom of the lake, you know, maybe down from 6 or 7 feet out of the weed beds up to the surface. The nymphs will hang at the surface film. They'll split open behind their eyes in the wing case area. Wriggling out is this winged insect that has three tails, a tiny little cream-colored body with a black or brownish, you know, thorax. And in this case, they have kind of creamy-colored wings. They're not dun-colored wings. They're kind of creamy-colored wings. They'll actually fly off of the surface of the lake, come and land on the side of the boat or on your shirt. And within moments of hatching from the nymph to the dun, they will split open. The dun will split open between the wings, and out wriggling out from that shuck is the spinner stage, which now has clear wings. Those go off to mate, and I don't know whether the mating flight for those happens that same night, or whether it takes a full 24 hours for those females to come back to the water to lay their eggs. But by this time, there are already spinners coming down to the water to lay their eggs to start the life cycle all over again. So it's one example of what all mayflies do, but it is one example of being able to watch the complete life cycle in a very short period of time. We oftentimes don't get to see other mayflies going through that molt because it's so hidden. It happens, you know, in the trees and brush, high up above the water's edge, and not where we would be able to view that happening. But it is a very exciting stage, and it's extremely important. So once those eggs are laid by the female spinner, they turn into nymphs on the bottom of the river or the bottom of the lake, and the life cycle begins again. And I think it's really cool that there are four distinctly different types of nymphs, a product of evolution to habitat and also to the species' success. So here on our waters, we have three common types of nymphs. We have the swimmer nymphs, which would include the blue-wing olives, the calabatus, and the thinus. We have the crawler nymphs, which would include the pale morning duns, the green drakes, and the mahogany duns. And we also have the clinger nymphs, which they've adapted to live in the fastest sections of the rivers, in the riffly, rapidy type waters, and they've adapted with a little kind of suction cup underneath their mouth where their bodies are much, much flatter, so that when they're crawling around on the rocks in that very fast water, they can suction onto the rocks without getting swept away. And those clinger nymphs include March Browns, pale evening duns, which is a really common hatch on the Deschutes for the rest of the summer, Epioris, which is a common hatch over on the Mackenzie. We saw, Tina and I were fishing the Metolius last Sunday and saw a good Epioris hatch just prior to the green drakes coming out. And then a hatch that I talk about a lot in my fishery reports in the spring and the fall for the Metolius, which is called a Synagnula mayfly. And so all three of the swimmer nymphs, the crawler nymphs, and the clinger nymphs have adapted to their habitats and hatch in much different ways. So the swimmer nymphs and the crawler nymphs actually, when they're ready to hatch, when they get to the time that the nymph is ready to become an adult, and they swim to the top of the river, and they use the rubbery surface film of the river itself, oftentimes called the meniscus, and they will break through that surface film, and the nymphs are hanging below the surface film. The adult is crawling out into the air that we breathe above. Those adults will float down the river for a short period of time, and at that stage, that creates quite a good feeding period for the fish. So the clinger nymphs do it a little bit differently. Out of the fast water, the adult fly actually comes out of the nymphal shuck down either at the bottom in the rocks of the river or someplace in between the bottom of the river and the surface of the river, and the adult crawls out and then wriggles its way up to the surface, swimming the best it can up to the surface, popping through the surface, and then floating along the surface for a bit, flying away. So many times you probably fished a soft tackle, like a yellow soft tackle or a March Brown soft tackle, you know, during a mayfly hatch. And for instance, the March Brown or Hare's Ear soft tackle is great during the springtime when those March Brown mayflies are out. The yellow soft tackles in various sizes are good for the other three clinger nymphs, the pale evening dun, the Epioris, and the Synagnula. If you carried a yellow soft tackle from a size 10 or 12 down to a size 18, you would match all three of those different mayfly emergers quite well. And it's also interesting to note that if you have the yellow soft tackle and put some floating on it and fish it as a dry fly, it's a pretty darn good emerger imitation for the pale morning dun, which is, again, a surface hatcher, but it's an important fly to have for sure. So, you know, as our listeners are listening to this and maybe thinking about, you know, tying their own flies to stock up their box or going to the fly shop to buy a few, adding some yellow soft tackles would be a really smart idea. And then the fourth type of nymph is really not common in Central Oregon, but may be present in isolated pockets. And these nymphs are called burrowers, and they include the species brown drakes and hexagenia. And those are both really large mayflies. And the burrowers, actually the nymph, burrows into the mud or the silt bottom and makes a little U-shaped home down in the mud. So they're really not available to the fish until they're quite ready to hatch. And they're not common here at all, but they're very common in your old stomping grounds where you grew up in the Midwest, or where you not grew up, but where you ended there with your career in the Midwest. And, you know, back in Michigan and Minnesota, Wisconsin, and even down into the South, the hexagenia hatch can be so prolific that they'll have to get the snow plows out to clear the bridges in the summertime of these, you know, mega hatches of millions and millions of hexagenias that come and cover the roads and make the roads slick and unpassable. I don't think we have anything quite like that happening here in Oregon, but it is important to note that the hex hatch is one of the only species of mayflies that we see both on the West Coast and the Midwest. So it kind of takes that one comment that I made earlier where the species are much different west of the Mississippi than they are east of the Mississippi, with the exception of a few, and the hex would be one of those.
I wanted to just, if I could interject, yeah, I lived in Michigan for a long time, as you know, and, you know, people that don't fly fish would just refer to the hexagenias as fish flies, you know, and they would just be all over the streets, your windshield, and just, you know, especially where I lived in Detroit, which was right along the Detroit River. And then, of course, fishing them up on the Ausable or rivers like that, you know, it was like you would be out long after dark, you know. It was a real really bizarre tradition, right, where people would stake out a space on the river, get their line out so they know how far they're going to be able to cast without getting into the brush across the river. And then you just sit there and you wait, and then it gets dark, and then you start hearing fish splashing, and you can't see them, and you're like, you know, trying to throw this huge, huge, huge mayfly, you know, out where the splash is and hoping for the best. You know, it was crazy.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And now, you know, since you've moved away from there, you've been away from there for a long time. But now there are glow in the dark fly lines and even, you know, glow in the dark wing materials that you could hit with a flashlight, while you're fishing those hex hatches at dark. You could hit it with a flashlight and make it glow so you can tell that you're not casting too far or you're on target with where the fish are feeding. And that on target with the fish are feeding, you know, maybe there's a little glint of light from the moonlight, or perhaps it's, you know, aiming your fly into the water by sound, you know, hearing the big splashy gulp of the trout rising to a big mayfly and trying to aim your cast to that sound. But I know it's a very exciting thing to do. And here in Oregon, we can find those hexes, you know, on the Williamson River, just south of us between the Bend and Klamath Falls. There's a big spring creek down there called the Williamson River. And it actually has a pretty darn good hex hatch that starts here in just a few weeks and lasts for two or three weeks. It, again, happens near dusk. So sometime between about 8 and 9:30 at night is when you're going to be fishing those hexes. Remember that the Oregon rules allow for fishing a half an hour before sunrise and a half an hour after sunset. So beyond those, don't break the law, but you do have some opportunity to be fishing in some pretty dark times in the evening to match that hex hatch. It can be really fun. And that fly is about the size of your pinky. So if you hold your pinky up right now and look at that, I know for sure it's the biggest mayfly in the United States. It may be one of the biggest mayflies in the world. And that other hatch, the brown drake, while not common around Oregon, it's very common in Idaho. Famous rivers like the Henry's Fork and the Silver Creek have great brown dray catches. And you know, years ago, as I grew up in Bend and used to fish a lot of kind of, you know, close to home places when the old mill district was actually the mill. And there were a few areas that my old, you know, fishing buddy and still my sometimes current fishing buddy Chester and I used to kind of sneak in down there and fish those muddy banks below what's now the Merrill Lynch offices. You know, we would fish down there and usually end up fishing, you know, some caddis hatches and rusty spinners in the evening. And every once in a while in the summer, we would see these great big brown mayflies floating by that I never was able to, you know, positively identify, but would guess were brown drakes. And so I think there's some isolated, you know, pockets of brown drakes even here in Central Oregon, and probably as close as, you know, probably about a mile away from where you live, Michael. So kind of, you know, kind of fun, you know, that it's all a mystery, and you know, some of it we decipher and some of it we can't. But I think that there's a lot of really cool stuff about mayflies. And, you know, for me, I have, you know, like a really serious passion for mayflies. And I hope that this talk helps others, you know, understand these important insects that are both, you know, elegant and super important to the food chain. And you know, just it's an incredible way to learn more about trout fishing, to learn more about entomology. And mayflies are an important part of that.
So as far as fishing them goes, particularly for fishing some of these very small mayflies or emergers or the nymphs, I think for me, what I prefer to do is like put those flies below a larger floating fly, like a stone fly or a larger caddis or something like that. Is that something that you find useful?
You know, I think it depends on where you're fishing them. So I you know, I would say in general, I would say that that's probably not the preferred method to go. The preferred method to fish, you know, the emergers, the cripples, the duns, and the spinners would be to use a long, light leader, a leader that has a thin butt section, like a Rio Supple Flex leader that's 12 feet long for most of the rivers, maybe a little bit shorter version for smaller rivers like the Fall River. And then add tippet to that. And the reason that I suggest that, and I think that it's important, is that if you're introducing two flies, particularly one much bigger fly, to the drift, and then trying to use that as kind of a, you know, a visual to be able to track the smaller fly, you're probably getting a lot of drag on both flies, particularly on the smaller fly, which is really the one that we're hoping is going to, represent what the fish are eating in that moment. And so I don't mind using like that dry dropper technique where you fish a bigger, you know, chubby or, foam beetle or something like that as a indicator for a small mayfly nymph. I think that works well because we're not trying to get a good drift on both the, you know, both the dry flies in two different current seams. But I don't think that fishing a big dry fly and another smaller dry fly behind it is very good for complex currents like we would find, for instance, on the Metolius or even in certain areas of the Deschutes or Fall River or Crooked River. It's just introducing too much opportunity to get a lot of drag on the smaller fly, and drag is what's going to be a turnoff to the fish. So they're just not going to come up and eat the fly if it's dragging. So that's my two cents worth. I know it works in some places, but if you want to catch more fish and have better drag-free floats, I would just recommend fishing one dry fly at a time on a long, light, you know, leader with light tippet.
But for nymph fishing, it would be okay to be able to put a dropper underneath a dry fly of some sort.
If you've got a little, you know, tungsten bead micro mayfly or skinny Nelson or a Perdigon that is the size and color of the predominant mayfly that's about ready to hatch. You know, fishing those underneath a foam dry fly or a more hackled dry fly, so you get good flotation to hold up that nymph, so that the nymph isn't pulling it under, because it's very easy for a tungsten beaded nymph to pull under a dry fly, and then you're fishing with two nymphs. You're not really fishing with a dry fly and nymph anymore. So it's important to think about, you know, the balance of that system. But that works well, because when the fish, you know, you're showing the fish two choices of things to eat, and if the fish are choosing the nymph, the little dry fly stops or gets pulled under, and you know it, just like you would know you got hit with a strike if you got hit with the nymph fishing with a strike indicator. For me, my favorite mayfly is the green drake. You know, green drakes hatch on the Lower Deschutes, they hatch on the Fall River, they hatch on the McKenzie, but where they really capture my heart is over on the Metolius, which I always consider to be, you know, my home waters. And, you know, they hatch, they start hatching around mid-May typically and go until about the 1st of July, and then they show up again in September and go into early October each year. Both hatches are really great hatches. They usually occur late in the afternoon, and they generate some very exciting fishing opportunities with some explosive takes. Most trout rise to mayflies or caddis on the Metolius with a dainty little sip at the surface. But when the drakes are out and about on the water, it'll be an explosion more often than not. We call it the drake take, and there is no doubt what you're seeing when you see a drake take compared to fish rising to the pale morning duns, which might have hatched about an hour before the green drakes, or might come out after the green drakes are over. The takes are so different from each other. And then, you know, pale morning duns are kind of the, you know, ubiquitous summertime hatch. They usually start in May. They go well into October. You'll see them on pretty much every river around here. They're you know, to me, when the pale morning duns are out, it's time to shine. It's our season. You know, winter's over. It just says summer to me. You know, while they don't hatch on summery days every single day, it certainly is the trend that it's moving in the direction of summer, or it has been summer for a long time. So pale morning duns are very special, probably the most important mayfly in the West, including right here in Central Oregon, are the blue-wing olives. As you would probably, I could probably say that there are blue-wing olives hatching on at least a stream in this region every single day of the year. So we see blue-wing olive hatches in the winter. We see blue-wing olive hatches in the spring, in the fall, and, of course, some in the summertime, too. They do tend to be more of a spring and fall hatch for the strongest hatches, but if you read my fishing reports, particularly coming up here in about a month in July and August, boy, you'll start to notice that I'll mention, hey, don't forget, you know, when the shadows come on the water, in the evening, those first shadows in the evening, to look for, you know, fish sipping blue-wing olives along the edges or in the eddies, because that's what they feed on for a bit during the summertime too. But in the spring and then the winter and in the fall, it could be the only thing that's hatching. Maybe a few midges mixed in, could be a few caddis later in the day, bigger caddis like October caddis, but blue-wing olives are by far the most important mayfly throughout the off-season months, where it could be the only hatch that you end up fishing. In those colder months, that happens right in the middle of the day. And then in the warmer months, they wait till evening, till the sun's off the water, to hatch, probably to hide a little bit, but also just to survive, to survive the heat, to survive the preying birds and the bats and that sort of thing. So it's all connected. It's really neat.
And on the lakes, Calabatus, that's something that I always look forward to up at East Lake or Palina Lake.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny how different the Calabatus hatchet on those two lakes are. You know, the Calabatus at East Lake and at Hosmer Lake are probably the two most prolific Calabatus hatch lakes that we have in the region. And Palina Lake is, less than 20 feet lower than East Lake, and it's, in elevation, and it is, just a mile and a half away. They're so close, and yet the Calabatus hatch at East Lake, we get a long hatch. They just started. I was there a few days ago, and there were a few out, and as we move in probably into this week, it's going to get crazy, and it's going to stay crazy for quite a while. We'll have a little lull in the action for a bit, and then it'll move on to the second brood, which means that the Calabatus that just hatched like this week, when they laid their eggs, those eggs are just going to mature as nymphs over the next about 2 months, and that second brood of mayflies will come out for this season, and those came from the first hatchers of this same year. The ones that lay their eggs in the later summer and into early fall, those nymphs will overwinter underneath the ice and not hatch again until next early summer. So that's one of the reasons that the hatch that happens in the early season are bigger sized mayflies than what hatches in the mid to late season, which are smaller size of the same exact species. So it's cool. And the Calabatus on the lakes are one of the main food sources for the trout, along with leeches and chironomids and damselflies. Calabatus, when I do a presentation for fly clubs on PowerPoint, Calabatus are one of the most important food sources that I talk about. If you're a lake angler, and you don't look forward to fishing Calabatus hatches, you need to have your blood pressure or your heart checked. I think there's something wrong with you.
I do look forward to it. All right. Well, thanks so much, Jeff Parent, for talking mayflies with us. And in our next episode, you'll be talking about caddis, right?
Caddis flies are the next one. Yep. And then I think we'll do one more that we'll call the forget-me-nots, and that'll be a really interesting show too of kind of things general insects that especially that we'd find on both lakes and rivers that are important that maybe sometimes people forget or get overshadowed by these more major hatches.
Thanks so much, Jeff Parent, for joining me here on the Radical Songbook.
What a wonderful day, Michael. Have a good one and enjoy fishing this week.
I will. Thank you.
Gone fishing. Gone fishing. Gone fishing today. Gone fishing. Gone fishing. Gone fishing. Gone fishing my troubles away.